I'm Matt Godbolt.
And I'm Ben Rady.
And this is Two's Compliment, a programming podcast.
Hey, Ben.
Hey, Matt.
Been a while. How are you doing?
Good. Yeah, good.
So, I'd like to abuse this podcast to ask you something that I would like to have asked you if we'd have met up in person. And it strikes me that it might actually be a good podcast episode. So I can kill two stones with one bird or whatever. Stone two birds with one kill. I don't know. One of those things.
I feel like that's so, like the fundamental basis of this podcast is that we just talk and then
it's an enforced meeting between you and I. Enforced. Wow. It sounds awful.
Encouraged.
Yeah, no, like I don't like this. No, but it's a point on our calendar where we will sit and talk to each other, even though, we don't work together anymore, which makes this less of a thing that we just do naturally. But anyway, my question, last I spoke to you, we were talking and you had some clever ideas about how you were sort of starting to use carefully AI to do some of the things that, I guess some of the more humdrum work or I don't know. How would you explain what you're doing? But I know that you have a clever way of using it.
Yeah. Well, I've gone through many, it seems like every few weeks or every month, you know, everything with AI and coding agents is changing so incredibly quickly right now. So it seems like every month or every few weeks, I have a new iteration. Oh.
So I might be like my mental model of where you are, maybe like several iterations behind, given that we haven't really caught up in a while.
I mean, you know, I don't think it's that far behind. I think you're maybe one version behind.
Okay.
The last, and it's just, you know, it's this whole progression. I think we've talked about it on prior podcasts, so I'm not going to recap from the beginning, but, the last iteration I was on was, creating, I had created, basically like a Docker image that I could run either locally or on remote machines or in the cloud in various places. And the way that I would use it is I would, it had an embedded Git server, which, you know, for those that don't know this, a Git server is just SSH, right?
Right.
There's really not a thing as a Git server. There's not a process that you run. It's like, oh, I killed my, you know, he grepped for my Git server. It's like, no, that's just SSH. SSH is your Git server. So it's...
And some like SCP kind of things. Like there's only a few things it can do. It's like there's a Git remote command that it runs, I think, right? Effectively on your behalf as...
Well, there's a... They recommend that you use a special shell for the for the Git user. But you don't have to, actually. You can just make a bare directory on another machine and use that as a Git remote. And that makes... Yes.
Not that kind of bear.
The Chicago Bear directories.
Chicago Bear directory.
The Chicago Bear Naked Lady directories.
Whoa.
Not to be confused with the terrible. I'm not going on the tangent. There's a bridge involved.
We're already tangenting.
I'm not going to talk about that.
Okay. Git is simpler than you might think. It's relatively just running a project on a remote.
It's real simple. There's no long-running process that needs to be managed with a Git server, right? But anyway, there are directories and permissions and sometimes shell and SSH configuration perhaps that should be done if you want to have the thing be particularly secure.
Right.
So I just created this this Docker container and
an SSH server you can get into inside the Docker container. And on the other end of that, it has all the things it needs to be a Git server.
Yeah. Yeah. And honestly, the only hard part about any of this is credential management, which I feel like is true 80% of the time, anyway, right? Like how do you get your public key registered? How do you get the credentials for the processes that you may want to run? But long story short, and actually there's one smaller other tangent is that there is actually an open source version of this that Aquatic released under the Aquanauts organization.
I was going to ask you about that.
Yeah. And it's very like, it's 60% complete at this point, right? Like I wouldn't necessarily, I mean, I would say it's great inspiration for your own implementation, which you can probably create with Claude in about an hour.
Right.
So there's not a real reason to necessarily use it out of the box, but it is there and it does kind of do this thing, which is finally punchline.
Yes.
The idea is that you set up Git remotes that point to the running instances of the Docker container, and the post receive hook for these Git remotes basically just runs the headless form of Claude, you know, Claude-P, with a very simple prompt. And that prompt is something like, make this code better, right? And the idea is that you have enough, you know, Claude.md and skills and other things perhaps checked into whatever repository it is that you're pushing, such that you can have like a local working copy and you're like, yeah, this code is like close, but it kind of sucks. You know, there's some, you know, commented out tests that fail, and there's some stubbed out methods and classes, and it's like, yeah, the general skeleton of sort of what I'm trying to do, but it's not really there yet. And I'm just going to commit that. And I'm going to push it to this remote that I've set up to run this, or maybe a few of them. And then it's going to just make it better. And then when it's done, after a few minutes, perhaps, and like each, you know, the instructions that I put in there tell it to do it in very incremental steps. So it's like, you know, for each to-do comment, for example, fix it and commit it with a description in the commit message and of what it is that you did.
This is committing into its own local copy of the repository. So it's got no way of getting out from there, right?
It's in the Docker container, right? So this is like the post receive hook for the sort of main repo directory in the Docker container.
Yeah.
Creates a working copy. And then Claude is operating on that working copy. And there can be multiple Claudes working on multiple working copies if you want to configure it that way.
You might use work trees on your local machine, but you're effectively just doing clones all over the place for each Claude. And so one thing is, like, usually they need a lot of guidance, and or they will say, hey, I'd like to edit this file now. And like, there's nobody on the other end of that. So how do you...
Well, so part of running it in Docker is that I run it with the dangerous permissions, right? And you know, evolved form of this might have some like IP tables rules or other things to try to limit its internet access. But the general idea here is to create a safe container so that it can run without, like, you're trying, the whole design of this is to not interact with it. That's the whole reason I created this in the first place, is because I was sick and tired of babysitting a bunch of Claudes. And so I'm like, no, I'm going to try to structure things and change the way that I work, such that the intention is I send you crappy code and then you send me commits. And then I can review those commits and decide whether it was that I liked what you did. But at no point should I ever have to interact with you in between those two points. Right.
Got it. And so how let me sort of reading that back to you. Yeah, this is a sort of self-contained world.
Mm-hmm.
And the only way that it starts up is you inject from the outside world something new into it by Git pushing.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And then it churns away and churns away and churns away. And you don't even, you're off walking the dog. You're off making tea.
Right.
And then when it's finished, how do you know, and how does that process?
So usually when I'm running these things, I'm running them in a tmux, so I can see the output of each one just for debugging purposes. Yeah. I'm not interacting with them, but I'm like looking at what they're doing. If one of them misbehaves or something goes wrong, I can poke it or restart it or look at what it did or whatever.
And with Claude-P, that's a like one-shot mode, right? You can't talk back to it or anything like that. It just keeps running and running and...
Uh-huh. Yeah, that's right.
I see, right. I've never really used that. I mean, I've used it like to say, Claude-P, tell me a joke, you know, that kind of thing, just to see that it works. Mm-hmm. But I always felt like something would need to be more babysat. But you're saying, no, give it the permissions, mm-hmm. let it run, and then just mark it at the end, right? You don't have to look at all the intermediate steps that it went through necessarily. You don't have to micromanage it, which is, of course, the exhausting and part that's frustrating, which you're trying to avoid, is this whole babysitting part.
Yeah. And I've tried this with different variations, like, you know, with like the agent teams, and you have like an agent, the lead of the agent team that is responsible for watching the commits go in and out. And, you know, having different agents working on different things, and all of it, it's all just like different variations on the same thing. None of it's like really any more amazing than anything else. you know, there are advantages and disadvantages maybe. But again, this is one of those things where it's like, I'm not even doing this anymore because it's been obsoletified.
Right. So that's what you were doing. That's what I remember you explaining to me patiently in the pub.
Yeah.
That's what you were doing. And I was like, cool, that sounds great. Because when I do use Claude, it feels like a powerful refactoring tool, but I have to be with it all of the time. And, you know, then if I try and do anything more complicated with it, and I have done some pretty complicated things with it, but like you just say, hey, simplify the code or whatever, then you have to sort of watch it. And it feels like, as I say, it's exhausting and you feel like you should be doing something else at the same time, but context switching is burning you out. And it would be nice to just throw it over a fence and say, I'll have a look in half an hour without the worry that inevitably when you say, here's a big piece of work to do, 1 second after tabbing away from it, it's stopped on a question saying, hey, would you like me to do this? And you come back to it and you're like, you've been doing nothing. Yeah.
Yeah. But so, the general model has not changed. The general model for me that I'm trying to work towards, which, you know, happens in fits and spurts and I run into problems with it. And, you know, but the thing I'm trying to move toward is a world where I create, it's a little bit like getting the right answer on the internet by posting the wrong answer. I create a vague, partially specified, broken in pieces skeleton of what it is that I want to exist. And then rather than creating like complicated prompts, I just put comments in the code because that sort of creates like the most context for Claude, right? Like instead of describing like, oh, in this function, in this file, maybe you should consider doing this. It's like, no, to do this, to do that. And then it can tell from the like surrounding function structure and maybe what's calling it and like the tests that are calling it, like it gathers more context and it like focuses because it's all about managing the context window, right? Yeah. Like you just have to get the right information in the context window, no more, no less. And so I feel like the best way to do that is to say, okay, I'm going to take a bunch of crappy things. I'm going to have one agent break up the work that it sees in those crappy things. And then each piece of crap is going to be worked on by one agent, which will create one commit. And then all of those commits together then come back to me as we clean up all your mess, right?
Got it.
And that is the workflow that I'm trying to move towards. Eventually I kind of want to get to a point where after that process is complete, I don't even need a PR. I don't even need anyone to review it because the PR is baked into like the continuous deployment process. And that's just something that, because here's the thing is we've created all these amazing tools for writing more code and making more changes. But as you know, if you have a pipeline with multiple stages and you increase the throughput of one stage without increasing the throughput of the next stage, all you do is create a queue at the next stage, right? You don't actually increase the throughput of the overall system at all.
This has been my life of like, it used to be that I would open up like say Compiler Explorer and look at the 40 open pull requests and go, oh gosh, I really have to get through these. And this is when humans were generating these pull requests, right? And I want to make sure that I give them the time and the thought to interact with them and say, yeah, this is great, or can you change this, all that kind of stuff. But it's a lot of work, and ultimately it's great. All right, I don't want to sound like I don't like that thing, right? But now when I ask an agent to do, like, hey, can you fix bug 27? It goes off, finds bug 27. Often it can, if they're a certain form. And then now instead of me working on bug 27 and effectively reviewing it because it's my own code, right? And you know, CE is not a professional product, so like, you know, I can merge straight to main if I want. I choose generally don't, but I still, you know, the review is kind of like advisory more than anything else. I can fix bug 17 and we're done. But now it's like, no, I've asked the robot to do the bit that I enjoy doing, and then I get just stuck with the bit that I don't like so much, which is the review part. And I'm like, and then you're like, oh, now I have 80 open PRs because I've got some, oh dear.
Yeah. Yeah.
So yeah. I mean, so kind of remove the, you know, without human interaction at some point, how do you prevent wildly spinning out of control things? I'm sure you've seen this, you know, models are getting better at this, but you know, I actually was working with one just a few minutes ago and I saw it several times go, no, let me take a big step back. No, let me take a huge step back, as it was kind of floundering and realizing it was floundering, and whatever magical crafting in the prompts and whatever they're doing, notices that and then tries to like do what a human would do, which I think is clever, but like, you know, but you know, you do need someone to say, wait a minute, you know, the otherwise you're going to be in like some kind of like millions of paper cuts all over your code base. How do you deal with that without a human going, wait a second, something else needs to look, I have the context and I can.
I mean, so I don't think that the way to do this is to give it a large chunk of work to do and then go and make tea and then come back in 30 minutes.
Okay.
That's not the model that I'm trying to move toward. Mm-hmm. The model that I'm trying to move toward is one where I'm doing enough work to get, you know, to sort of like seed the work of some number of agents. And while those agents are churning away, I'm kind of like thinking about what the next step is and maybe creating those pieces, or some of those pieces. And one advantage of this model is that, you know, you can do a git pull at any time. And so if like the easy ones start coming in first, right? So like if you have a to-do comment that's like, you know, simplify this method, right? There's some unnecessary complexity in here. Like, you know, you'll see that one finish and then it's like, all right, that took all of 10 seconds. Git pull. Okay, cool. I'll get that. And I'm going to look at that. And so it's not like, you know, create a big bunch of work, push off a big bunch of work, get back a big bunch of work, review a big bunch of work. It's more like create a bunch of individual things, or maybe just a handful, push them out, and then start pulling them in and reviewing them and reading through them and maybe even iterating on them, right? Be like, you know, I'm going to revert this commit. We're going to try again, or I'm going to, you know, add another comment in that says like, this still needs more work.
So just as I get my, maybe I missed this part. You can pull from this repo and then it's just a different remote for you. So you would, you're still, as in you, Ben, are still the main repo is on GitHub or GitHub Enterprise or wherever it is. And then you are just pulling from yet another source or pushing and pulling to another source, much as if it was like a vendor branch. It's just like, this is the agent repo.
Right.
I see.
Yeah, okay. It's a different Git remote. And usually I'll just name the remote for whatever the host name is that the Docker image is running on. Right.
Makes sense. I get it. So and then ultimately those changes make it through into the mainline through you having pulled them and looked at them. And so you've looked at them locally rather than through GitHub. So
exactly.
That's interesting. So that's different from what the model that I've been sort of trying to work towards myself in my own way, because for me the goal, and this is very compiler explorer centric, is many of the open issues in compiler explorer are please install compiler X, and compiler X is, and we have readmes for this, people can send pull requests for it, but there's usually it's a multi-step process, you know, it can be up to 4 steps, which is a pain, but you know it's and it's almost automatable. You know, someone says, hey, I have this Clang build over here. I'm like, great. So what GitHub repo is it? Oh, yeah. Which branch is it in? Oh, yeah. Right, whatever. And you go and pull it down. It's like, yeah, it didn't build. I said, oh, yeah, you need these extra flags because we need these things on our build. And you're like, okay, that can be done, right? You know, there's no – but I had to try the build out, which is, you know, like a 45-minute build on a beefy machine, and then discover that actually, no, I need to change it. And I have to iterate a few times to get the exact flags. Then having built it, it needs to be installed, and then the install usually picks up a few things, and then it has to be configured, then it has to be tested, whatever. Each of these is a different repo for unfortunate legacy. Well, I don't know if they're unfortunate, but for reasons, right? You know, most people who pull the Compiler Explorer repository aren't actually installing 3 terabytes of compilers. They're about to use it on their local machine, and they don't want to have anything to do with all of the things that to do the orchestration and infrastructure of Compiler Explorer, the website. So that's a separate thing. They just have the code, right? And the code is just versioned, and we pull in version 12 of the code into, you know, that kind of stuff. So, but it does mean that now there's 2 repos you have to manage. And then similarly, even in the infrastructural thing, it doesn't make sense to have like every Docker container we've ever had to build, every possible compiler ever gets rebuilt every single time every push happens. So they're in their own repositories and so on. And so it all makes sense, but it's also painful and it requires orchestration and multiple steps. Anyway, popping the stack, it is nearly automatable, but you need something with half a brain to watch it and go to go, oh yeah, maybe we need to change this flag. Oh, it has completed now. Now I can test install it locally. Oh, it does work locally. Okay, cool. Now I can make the pull request, all these things. And so that workflow is what I would like to manage so that I can sick the something on that and say, can you just do this thing and send me the pull request when it's done? And I can review it on my phone while I'm walking the dog and go, yes, that's fine, and merge it. Because most of the time I can see if it's okay. And if in particular I can see that it's been through the test steps and the CI build has given it the clean bill of health. So that's what I'm working towards, to try and design away that kind of thing. And it's kind of a different model, I think, from yours. Is more of a, I want to use this as a pair programmer or a mob programmer with me, and I'm kind of pulling and pushing with it. Is that a fair observation, or would you say it's different than that?
I don't know that it really, I wouldn't really compare it to like pair programming, or I wouldn't compare it to any practices that we have used in the last 30 years, honestly. It's just a new and different thing. It's just a different, it's just a different way to build software. The closest analog is, I've had situations in my career where I have intentionally created an incorrect PR and sent it to someone.
The same, you know, someone's wrong on the internet kind of.
Like you get into a discussion with someone and they're like, I think you should do this. And it's like, you know what? The easiest way for me to describe what I'm trying to do here is to do a third of it. And then you'll see the other two thirds. So I'm just going to do that. Now, you know, it's very limited in the situations where I've done that, right? But now it's basically that all the time. Or at least that's what that model was, which again,
maybe
is not what I'm actually doing right now. But
I was going to say, you just made me think of something else that I've found is a useful thing for me to do now, is that the cost of prototyping with this, now I'm just talking generally about it. This is going to be a meandering conversation. Sorry, listener. The cost of exploratory work is so low now that I will happily, so I now have a restricted user on my machine, and I run it in a sandbox, and I put a tmux into it like you're suggesting, and it allows me to run in YOLO mode as well. So then I can kind of say, oh, knock yourself out, go, and you know, I don't care. The worst you can do is delete your entire directory and everything you have in here, which in cases will inconvenience me not one bit. You know, you'll stop working and then I'll come find you. And it has, you know, it's a separate Unix user. It has no credentials, all the things, all those good things. I don't necessarily internet sandbox it as well. I mean, if I told it to hack my network, I'm sure it could. But anyway, the point is, I can point it at saying, so like, I don't know how to do this. Can you just have a spirited attempt at it? And then I can see where you get stuck and where the problems lie. Right, the cost of prototyping and spiking out an idea and going, would it be possible to do X? Like, hey, what if we were to completely replace this? So in the window behind you, my JavaScript BBC Micro emulator, it's like a 400K download in the web thing, because it has two separate gunzip libraries for like very ancient reasons, right? There's just like two, you know, silly reasons. And nowadays browsers have decompression stream, but they don't support the one thing that I kind of need in it. And I'm like, is it possible to hack the heck out of it and make it work reliably on both Node and Chrome and Firefox? Go.
Yeah.
And it came back, and I can see behind you now, it's like, yeah. And now I haven't looked at the code. It may be an atrocity, in which case I'll throw it away and we'll pretend it never happened. But if it's okay, that was great.
Yeah.
Right? And that's utility to me. And it's also not the kind of thing that I particularly want to do. And again, this is something interesting. Maybe this is a pivot now, right, away from the kind of things that we're automating. It's like, and maybe you're feeling this too, because you said about like the way software engineering is changing, the way that you're developing. This is something new that is not pair programming or mob programming, whatever it is, whatever this is nowadays. It's LLM assistant, agent assistant coding. And, you know, there's a lot of people who quite reasonably have a lot of issues with it. There are people who have, you know, issues in terms of the power that it's using and things like that. And that is a very valid concern, but not one I want to talk about here for all the complicated reasons that I'm not well thought about. And honestly, a little bit, putting my fingers in my ears and hoping that some clever person solves this, you know, I suppose I'm pinning my hopes on the fact that there is at least one prior piece of art that says that you can think and not take an entire data center's worth of power, because it's between my ears at the moment, right? And it's not, apparently not taking more than a few tens of watts. I don't know what a brain takes, but it's certainly not hundreds of kilowatts, right? Anyway, that to one side. The folks of our age, I think, are having a bit of an interesting experience here, because, you know, we can see the utility of being able to do stuff very quickly in prototype, like I just described. We're seeing the utility of getting stuff done really quickly, which, And maybe we're sort of still discovering what really quickly is whether or not there is it is a silver bullet or it's, you know, just a sort of copper bullet that's not quite as good as we think it is, whatever, something like this, right? It's right, like it's right. a good thing. Maybe we're not as effective as we think we are. Maybe that will play out in the medium term and we'll discover that. But what it means is that we're not programming as much anymore. Like literally hand on keyboard, open bracket, type some things, close bracket. I don't feel like I'm doing that. There have been days recently where I've spent the entire day going, and then at the end of the day, I was like, oh, let me just look at the code. Oh, I haven't opened even Visual Studio Code. I've just been talking to various things. It's like I'm chatting in Slack and I'm chatting in Windows and things are happening and I'm reviewing them on like pull request level things, but I'm not necessarily programming in the same sense. And like, there's definitely a part of me that's like, oh,
yeah,
I like that.
Uh-huh.
And so I'm, you know, maybe I'm just using this as a, you know, therapy session. I'm still trying to work out how I feel about it. Like, I can't deny that I'm excited to get things done that are exciting to me.
Mm-hmm.
And I enjoy the outcome, but I feel like maybe I'm missing something on the journey, you know, and maybe that will bite me in the future as well.
Yeah, right. No, I've thought about that a lot, you know, in the last 3 to 6 months. And, you know, the conclusion that I kind of came to is that the career that I enjoyed for 25 years is now over. And my number one priority in exploring all of these things, and the reason why I change it every month, less than a month, is because the number one priority is that the new thing is fun. The productivity gains, I don't care. I'm sure they'll come.
Right.
Like, it's kind of inevitable that they'll come in some form. I'm not worried about that at all. The sort of efficiency, the like, you know, resume fodder of like, did you use this? I don't care about any of that. The only thing I care about is that I create a new way of working that is fun. Because if it's fun, I'll do it. And if it's not fun, then I won't do it. And if I do it, then I'll get better at it. And if I don't do it, then I won't. So the only thing that matters is create something that's fun. And the great thing about this is that it's like a brand new world. Like,
yeah,
it's, you get to reinvent the rules all over again. You know,
yeah.
I've been having a lot of discussions with people lately about maybe rewrites aren't a bad idea anymore.
Yeah, maybe not.
Maybe language choice doesn't matter anymore because you can just have it rewrite it in whatever language you want. Right. Like, there's all of the rules might be out the window. Some of them are not going to be, but we don't know. Right.
Some of the rules that are closest to your heart are probably still very valid. You know, like the fact that having a strong framework around the outside about sort of intersubjective and test for, is this what we want it to be?
Yeah.
Be it, you know, I said test. I was trying to avoid the word test. No, but like, is test, right?
It's functional verifying test. Correctness, right?
Yeah.
The requirement that you verify that the software that you produce works correctly. For the definition of correctly that you probably are in charge of maintaining, right?
Yeah.
Like, that's your job, is to, what does it mean to be correct, right? Like, yeah, that's why you're there, is to figure that out. None of that has changed. The tools that we use to do it, I'm sure, are going to change dramatically.
Right.
Yeah.
Right. It's interesting. So I was having a discussion about how the kind of, if you cast your mind back to one of our first guests, Claire McRae, and the I always want to call them golden tests, acceptance tests.
Yeah,
is that the right one?
Approval tests, so sorry. Perhaps
approval tests. Thank you. Yeah. Oh gosh, yeah. But you know, those tests seem to be not. Let me try and think. I'm trying to remember what the discussion was. I prefer a well-designed unit test, because then I, you know, like you, right? Mm-hmm. If something breaks, one test breaks in one place and you don't have like this collateral damage of like, well, right, I changed the log line and now everything is different apparently.
Yeah.
Not everyone thinks that way. And someone made a reasonably compelling argument to me that I'm forgetting exactly, but of like, in an LLM driven world, the value of having a targeted unit test that tells you what the problem is not as great as the fragility of like, oh, I'm changing my API, yeah, and now everything has to be updated. Whereas like the bloody output of your program should be the same. Kind of makes sense to me then. But like, it doesn't sit comfortably with me yet, but I could see it. And I was like, this is the first time I'm nodding a little bit towards this. Mm-hmm. This
No, it's funny because, again, all the rules are up for debate. Let's debate. I could make the argument that the sort of isolation of those tests in the sense of like one bug produces one test, mm-hmm. What I would have called an informative test, is less important, but only to the extent that the tokens don't cost you too much, right? Uh-huh. Like if you got Claude or many Claudes in a very tight loop running tests over and over and over again, and they're trying to make changes, and every time they make a change, you get hundreds of failing tests, that's going to fill up the context window pretty fast. Yeah. But the thing that might matter more is speed, right? Like the faster your tests run, the more iterations you can go through. And if you can automate that, then you can get things done very quickly, right? These are things that we're going to have to find out.
Yeah. Yeah, no, I think that's very, very valid. It's, in fact, one of the more interesting things I have seen people do again recently is change the model that they're using to a smaller one that's dumber because it can go faster.
Yeah.
It's like, I don't care that it's dumb because, you know, it's protected from itself. And then I can use a slower model at the end to kind of like clean mm-hmm. it up or whatever.
Yeah.
And that was like, oh, that is interesting. So let me ask you another question. This is really far reaching now. Sorry, we've reached half an hour into this conversation. We had literally zero plan. How do you feel about the fact that you're working and then you get a, you know, 500 error from the Claude endpoint, and now suddenly everything comes to a slamming halt and you're like, oh, I can't work. And as a proxy for, what does it mean for my hobby that I could previously do with an air-gapped computer? Mm-hmm. And obviously there's 100 reasons why that's not true, but let's just go with it for now. An air-gapped, right. You know, I'm on the plane, I have no internet access, although also that's not true anymore. I'm just tinkering around and I can do my thing and I'm enjoying it. Suddenly, it's not only the fact that there is no internet there, it's the fact that there is a vendor that is the thing that is preventing you. You know, as much as I'm an Anthropic fanboy, that does scare me.
Yeah.
And I'm like, oh, shucks. What do you, yeah.
Yeah, that's a real serious problem. That's a real serious problem. And, you know.
You can see why folks are looking at, like, you know, self-hosting solutions, even if they're, again, dumber models. It's like, I have a rack of GPUs behind me or whatever, and it's running there, and then I know where I stand with it. You know, it's my own electricity bill and my own.
Well, this leads me, and the local models thing leads me to the next iteration of things that I am doing. And one of the reasons why I am doing it. The next iteration is I am just fully leaning into remote development environments. Uh-huh. And I am trying, I have right now a project where I'm trying to just set up an Amazon AWS account. It's really just the EC2 instance and a few other attendant things right now. But basically, like, the way I want to think about this is that, like, I do all of my programming in a cloud account. And I'm doing that for multiple reasons.
Mirrors the kind of way that you and I've had to work in finance for a while.
Yeah,
anyway,
it's not
for
that
those
foreign.
Reasons of like, yeah, exactly. It's not. Yeah, we've gotten used to it. And also, you know, IDEs are good at this these days.
Yeah, remote development. Over SSH works pretty well. Yeah.
For me, it works a treat as well. You know, I'm forever just using Mosh to talk to the machine that's under my desk here, where the real development happens for the same reason. And it doesn't matter which laptop I'm on or where I am, I'm the same, dropped into the same environment, carrying on with the same sessions that were there from before. So it's, but. Yeah, so you're setting this up.
Yeah, no, and the metaphor here, I think a useful way to think about this is like a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away, when we built systems, they ran on a computer. Like you'd go into a, you know, server closet in your office building and they'd be like, all right, this is the Dell computer that we got to run our, you know, whatever. And it was on that computer. And then we built, you know, much bigger systems that run on lots of computers in the cloud and all of that. This is what we're doing with the development environment. I think development environments are going to move from it's running on your computer that's like on your desk or your laptop to like, no, it's a whole system of interconnected services and computers and things for you individually, so that you can do all of these things with agents, right? And a key part of this is security. Right? Because, you know, a lot of times in a lot of environments that I've worked in, they've had this sort of like, you know, hard exterior, soft interior security model where you're protecting yourself from outside attacks, but then inside the network is fairly loosey-goosey, right? And I think when you have a structure of like, you know, very competent engineers internally, and you are reasonable about taking precautions and various things, that model works really well. I don't want to set a whole bunch of Claude YOLO agents loose in an environment like that. Right.
Right. So seen the tweets from people saying, Claude just deleted the database, whatever, you know. And like the thing is, you and I as humans have made idiotic mistakes in our time, maybe not to that extent. And that's only to be expected. And the only thing that you can do to protect that is to make sure those humans know the consequences and are scared of them and don't do them. But you can't scare the agents. So you have to just bubble wrap them and say, you're not allowed to do the things that you think you're allowed to do. Even when it would be extremely useful for them to be able to alter the live production database to do a rollout for you or whatever. You're like, no, that's not how we're doing things here.
Yep. Yep. And you know, it's so
have fine-grained controls and say, like, you've got read only to these things. You can do what you like with those. I'm with you. Sorry, I cut you off.
And cloud providers are really good at fine grain access controls. It's something that they've been doing for decades, right? So I'm like, all right, my whole development environment now is going to live in AWS, Google Cloud, doesn't really matter. And it's going to be managed in Terraform, and it's going to have this like very particular setup to it. And that's going to do a number of things for me. One, it's going to solve the security problem for me. So I don't have to worry about, like, I don't have to retrofit my company's internal network to have passwords everywhere, right? And then the second thing it's going to do for me is it's going to at least potentially allow me to start running my own models, right? So I can at least explore the idea of being less dependent on third parties in order to basically do my job. Because right now, when that happens, I have to drop into the slow mode and be like, all right, well, I'm going to fire up, you know, PyCharm or IntelliJ or Vim or whatever it is. Yeah. And I'm just going to run the test myself and I'm going to go back to the way that I worked for, you know, 25, 30 years. And that is slower. It's definitely a lot slower. And so I think this is just like, again, and I expect this to last like a month.
Because things move so quickly. It's funny. I did a panel on AI agents and the use of it in C++ at CPPCon, and they just released a video, and it's like, you shouldn't have bothered. You know, that was 6 months ago. The landscape's completely different now. You know, it is. So this is really interesting. I know I asked you about this, and that was your opinion and whatever and thing. But obviously, you're now almost doubling down on the vendor lock-in with the fact that you're now like, well, I'm running on AWS. Now, obviously, other providers are available, that kind of stuff. But like,
I can point that Terraform somewhere else, and it'll do just fine. You know what I mean? I'm not really doing anything special there. The IAM permissions are a little bespoke, but other than that,
There's a lot of things that. But yeah, having, you know, holding a thing in your hand and saying, this is my thing and I can do whatever I like with it. You know, in fact, until earlier, I had my BBC Micro behind me, which is like the epitome of like literally everything is inside this box. Maybe we have to accept that that's going, or, you know, like everything's a cycle. It used to be, you know, everyone would go and get timeshare on their timeshare machines, the only thing you had, you know, it's kind of, we've come back around to that. But there's something about the models being so, you know, in principle, I can buy computers, I can rack them in my basement, I can connect them up with a network switch, and I can go on and I can be like, yeah, I can continue to do this, you know, that's what I like to do. But I can't necessarily get access to the technology that lets me run an agent in the same way. Right. And that's not just, you know, the GPU stuff. It's like the whole IP of it and whatever. And that just sort of, I suppose, having been so open source for so long, where, you know, in principle, I can compile every piece of code that I use from source. Not that I ever do, but I could on a machine that is mostly open to me and is well understood. That's one thing. To have it sort of like taken away, it would be like, oh, yeah, my company uses SQL Server from Microsoft. You're like, but it doesn't work. You're like, tough. about that. It doesn't sit well, but I can't deny and this is what I wanted to go back to, you know, as we've kind of probably should finish up soon, but like the joy, the fun aspect and making it fun. I am having fun. That's probably why I'm so invested in trying to find a way to make it work well for me so that I can enjoy the things that I'm doing. And and that's why I think about this whole difference between outcomes when you just, I want the cool thing, make the cool thing. And I don't actually care how the cool thing was made. And having the cool thing is more interesting to me than the making process. But then, you know, accepting that some of me enjoys the making process, but I knowing that I can choose, certainly in my personal life, I can choose to make the cool things. And the hope is that the thing maker, the automatic thing maker, can do the things that I can't do, or I don't want to do, rather. And then I'm just left with the things that I can do and I am good at and are my USP. And that's what I hope. We're not there necessarily yet. And now I can't remember where I was going with this big, long meander. But yeah, the joy. Oh, yeah, it's burnout. I want to just talk about that because I get so, you know, I'm reminded of the times when I first got into programming and I was burning the midnight oil, doing all sorts of things, and I would go to sleep and I'd wake up early in the morning and my mind was still buzzing with like, oh, I could do this thing, oh, I wonder if we could do that, whatever. And I'm finding that about programming again, but it's perhaps got a slightly darker tone to it, because all the time I'm not able to feed the agents that are doing useful work for me, I feel like it's wasted time. And so I, you know, and somebody was saying to me, someone I work with was saying like, oh, I woke up in the night the other night and I got up and I was like, well, I might as well just check on what it's doing, and kind of logged in to just, you know, hit enter a few times on some Claude sessions. And there's a certain, like, there's a dark pattern around that. You know, there's a meme went around about the fruit machine where, fruit machine being a slot machine in to translate for you, where, you know, you pull the crank, which is like hitting the yes, do this, and maybe you get the right answer this time. And there is a bit of that. And that you know, I don't know how I feel about that either. It feels, you know, so I feel like overwhelmed, overworked, burnt, because I'm context switching all the time, but also excited. And I'm trying to pick through that. And I wondered if, having me just talk to you like for 10 minutes, what do you, if you could somehow.
Yes.
All right.
I think you're not the only person that is feeling that right now. We're one of the things that we're going to have to figure out. You know, I've used the phrase, I think, on this podcast before, sustainable pace. What does sustainable pace look like when you, basically you're building software at the speed of thought, right? Like, there's literally no barrier. I mean, you know, maybe this is a few years ahead of us, but it's like there's literally no barrier between you coming up with an idea and implementing it. One of the, you know, we had a mutual friend that pointed out that he thought that this sort of agentic programming would separate out programmers that love to code and programmers that love to make things, right? I think that's a little bit more of a two dimensions in a plane for me. That I have, because I enjoy both aspects of it, right? Like, there's a puzzle solving aspect to writing code that I enjoy. That's why I play games like Fractorio. But I also love building things for the sake of building things. And if I could build them at the speed that I can think of them, that would be great. One of the things that I've noticed is that I think actually this has diminished the number of personal projects that I take on, because in the past, I would choose projects because I would be getting something from both of those dimensions. Like, oh, this would be a useful thing, and it would be a fun puzzle to solve, right? And now the puzzle aspect is completely gone, right? There's no puzzle enjoyment from it at all. And so there's a certain category of them that just don't meet the bar anymore, right?
Like, interesting to put,
But I'm also taking on personal projects that I never would have dreamed of doing before, because it would have been too time consuming, right? I think the net number of them is actually lower, but the quality is like not better, but more useful, because it's a personal project. What does better even mean? More useful, right? Like, there's more of a chance that I'm going to actually use it, and it will not just be a thing that I built 3 years ago and then shoved in a folder somewhere and then forgot about. Right.
It is, it's definitely changing. You reminded me of a tweet I saw by Ellie Huxtable, who is the person who writes Atuin, the shell history thing. I don't know if you know it. I can't live without it now. That's another sort of crutch I have to live on as my memory disappears and I have to use my infinite searchable shell history as my, like, the most important intellectual property I create. She was retweeting somebody who was high school student who was like trying to build a web browser using agents to help them do it. And it's like, and I think her point was something along the lines of like, if you aren't doing this kind of thing, are you even exploring the space anymore? Now that the barriers have come down so much, well, you know, like, this is an amazing kind of thing you can do. Now, whether you're successful or not, this is the new thing that you can, you know, this is a new achievable goal, right? Or at least, you know, right. You can learn a whole bunch of stuff about why it's not trivial to do this kind of thing. You know, right. I was fascinated by that. And I thought, wow, you know, what it would be like to be a teen in this environment. But I would like to put a massive thumbprint thing, which I now have made a horrible noise, the microphone is, I'm not going to like this in the edit. I come from this as somebody who can afford to pay for the access to these systems at the level, which means effectively I don't have to think about it so much. I don't hit the limits very much, right? And that is different from somebody who is, you know, unable to afford even, I say, the most minimal access to Claude. And that is not a good feel, actually, compared to, like, you know, if you could get a computer in the old days, even some time on your friend's computer, you could learn to program. And now it's like, nope, you need a $20 a month subscription at the absolute minimum to even start the whole process.
And honestly, that doesn't stay that well. Yeah, those $20 a month subscriptions are clearly being subsidized and are not sustainable and are, if you look at, especially what's been happening with some of the rate limiting lately, like it's getting,
so I understand.
Yes, it's introducing this whole other like barrier to entry for programming.
Yeah.
Which is not great.
Not great, but you know, also, if you're the craftsman, you can buy a set of tools and, you know, whittle away at a piece of wood and make something beautiful, and that's wonderful and it's a new thing. But like, you know, I can't operate a mill because I can't afford it. It's like, well, fine, you know, maybe that's okay anymore, but it's just that it's always been something that is so emotionally important to us and our backstory. The reason that you and I are even talking to each other now on this podcast is because we were whittling away, right?
It's possible that history will tell of a brief period of time where, unlike pretty much every other professional engineering industry, civil engineering, mechanical engineering, maybe not mechanical engineering, you could essentially, for the cost of a laptop, have everything that you needed to apply your profession. And that was incredible. What an amazing thing to have occurred. That's not how normally things occur.
No, right? That's true.
You know, you can't be a chemical engineer at home unless you're just brewing beer. And even then it's sort of like, you know, how are you going to scale that? You're not going to get a job at, what is the name of that chemical company? It's like we don't make the thing, we make the thing that goes whatever, some big chemical company whose name I can't remember right now, because you know how to brew your own beer.
Isn't your wife a chemical engineer?
Well, that's why I brought that one stuff out. She worked in the petroleum industry for a little while, and you definitely can't do that at home. Nor should anyone ever for any reason
True. Oh boy. Somehow we're at like very long time into this podcast. Well, we should probably stop talking about it. But
this is a topic that could go on forever. So
I know, but it's really interesting to check in. And I mean, I think unlike most of our podcasts, this one will probably go out somewhat contemporarily. So maybe this will be up to date by the time people hear it still. You know, like we won't be so ridiculously out of date, rather. So I'd be interested. You know, it's a tough and interesting and very deep topic, and has a lot of dimensions that we're not used to dealing with as programmers. You know, like which sort algorithm is better is like where my you know, right? What cache lines should be pulled in, how the branch predictors work. These are things that I'm kind of more comfortable with, but when it's like, you know, hey, this may change the whole nature of what we do as a profession, and it may exclude people, it may cause environmental damage, but it's also very exciting. I don't know how to navigate it it is a kind of riding the wave
world. We're in a crazy world.
Everything's friend new. Let's leave it there for this time, and we'll let our listeners let us know if they want us to continue to ranting and rambling about this, or whether we should go back to something a little bit more traditionally twos complimenty. But well, either way, this has been fab. Thank you for bringing me up to date with what you're doing.
right.
And we'll have to try and find a time to grab a coffee in person
next time at the bar. That'll be the plan.
That works. Yeah. That works for me.
Yeah.
All right, friend. Until next time.
You've been listening to Two's Compliment, a programming podcast by Ben Rady and Matt Godbolt. Find the show transcript and notes at www.twoscompliment.org. Contact us on Mastodon. We are at twoscompliment@hackyderm.io. Our theme music is by Inverse Phase. Find out more at inversephase.com.